What's up, gang? Thanks for listening to the Undiplomatic Podcast, the show with undiplomatic takes about the foreign policy scene. I'm your host, Van Jackson, and today... Wait, fuck, what am I doing? I thought I was recording.
That was pretty good so far.
I forgot how I do this. Shit, hold on.
1 week.
Oh, so we got the crew today. Gabby Magnuson.
Hey.
Jake Dello.
Greetings.
And Pete McKenzie.
Hey, yeah.
All right, so two quick hits before we get into everything. One is a shout out to Judd Apatow. Yes, the fucking comedy writer, producer guy, 40-year-old virgin. I'm blanking on all the other hits, but there's like...
Pretty much the same movie.
Yeah, they're all variations on the same thing. There's a lot of weed. And the comedian of my generation... But he did this interview with MSNBC where he called out Hollywood for, quote, being, He says, quote, they bought our silence with money. And he's talking about China. And he says that basically because all of these production studios expect distribution in China, they do business with China, Chinese investors are involved in Hollywood, like in deep. This is like not exactly a secret. Everybody knows this. But the consequence is that nobody in Hollywood is willing to produce anything that throws shade at China or that calls out human rights abuses. If you'll notice, like the last movie that I saw where China was a bad guy was fucking Spy Game in 2001 with Brad Pitt. And it wasn't even China as a bad guy. It was like China's just China. And it's like spy versus spy, you know? But like, that's the last thing I can remember. And then you have like movies like Red Dawn where it's like, it was literally China was the enemy. And then at the last minute, the studio changed it to be fucking North Korea invading the US as if that was even remotely possible. It's not. But you do it only because you fear China's retribution. And so this is like a longstanding problem. And a lot of me, especially me, but a lot of China hawks have been very critical of Hollywood because of the obvious censorship. This is functionally anti-democratic Chinese money, undermining liberalism itself. And that's a huge fucking problem. And it's huge that somebody with a big name in Hollywood is calling it out, being self-critical and self-aware and trying to establish a corrective. But to me, this is also like, this is the kind of thing that I worry about with China. Like, I'm not so worried about the PLA building a new aircraft carrier. I'm not so worried about them increasing their nuclear stockpile by 5% over the next 10 years or something like that. I'm worried about how their policies and their state-backed firms influence actual democratic discourse and democratic political processes. The ability to actually exercise liberal freedoms of speech, as one example, Hollywood being this big blinking example that Judd Apatow's calling out. Like, this is something that China is doing damage to the Western world, basically, legally. There's nothing there. This is not like corruption in the traditional sense of like graft. This is peddling fear and playing off of fear for your political ends. And it's the kind of thing that like I worry about a lot. It's the kind of thing I see in New Zealand where you see the absence of debate about China and what to do as a result of being dependent on trade and investment with China. When you elevate China to being this like strategic partnership that's so essential for your economy and your dairy industry or whatever, you proactively have chambers of commerce, you know, and interest groups not like taking op-eds, taking a pro-China stance, saying if you're going to criticize China at all, you're xenophobic or racist. They're trying to like own the frame. And then they're not doing, they are very mindful, and the foreign ministry, which controls foreign policy in New Zealand, very mindful of any kind of blowback that they might get from China. And so they don't have debates. And then you have the elite community of like policymakers and think tanks and everything, such as it is, not having debates about China. It's all co-opted. It's all proactively self-censored. And the result is that you're sort of locked in and you don't have the ability to reason your way out of it. That's super pernicious. That's what I'm concerned about more than debt trap diplomacy, more than the next aircraft carrier, more than even, to me, even more than like, will China go to war with India? That is a big, you know, concern, but that's more remote of a possibility than the very real thing that we're facing of self-censorship, of like strategic debate and strategic discourse because of getting Chinese money. So I have a problem with that. Shout out to Judd Apatow.
You know, I'm careful to bring up New Zealand politics in the podcast, but we just had a multi-party, the minor party leader debate for our election last night. And it did strike me, as soon as a question was asked about China, which I was surprised was even asked, but they cut straight to the crazy conspiracy theorist, almost to point out, like, okay, if you're going to be anti-China, this is the sort of xenophobic nutter that you'll be painted out to be. And one of the most outspoken sort of reactionaries I've ever seen is John Tamahere. He's the leader of the Māori Party. They've run an anti-immigration campaign. But as soon as they switched to the talk about China, it was, they're a great ally, they're a great trade partner, we should do more business with them. It was like, what are you talking about? That doesn't make sense with your platform. And I know they're not saying it to protect our sensibilities, you know, so it worries me too, man.
It drives me crazy. Elite interests are served by good relations with China. It's not clear to me how that benefits normal people in any democratic society, particularly when the opportunity cost is expressive freedom. Having real public policy choices put before you, like the frame that is being used for decision making in democratic countries everywhere is distorted in favor of China and against favor of like free expression, basically. I'm glad somebody's awake to it in Hollywood. That's all I'm saying.
I'm happy someone's awake in Hollywood.
It's the guy who's fucking baked off his ass, who's speaking truth to power. Like, what's happening? Second quick hit. The Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, the think tank that I always talk about as if I like them, and yet I say I have mixed feelings about them. They have an East Asia program and came out with like a set of principles, which is worth reading if you're into Asian security, and you most certainly are probably if you're listening to the pod. You know, the Quincy Institute is all about restraint in foreign policy, kind of like an anti-militarist positioning. There are, you know, deep progressives in the Quincy Institute, even though they're like a nonpartisan thing technically. So these principles for East Asia, it's interesting because they are like the outer boundary of opinion on foreign policy stuff. Like they're the anti-Washington in many respects. And what they came out with on East Asia, like to me, it was, there's a lot, I said on Twitter, like there's a lot that's underspecified because it's just principles. So it's hard to endorse what they're saying, but it's also hard to be opposed to what they're saying. So like they talk about needing to kind of, they don't use this language, but it's like to tilt the offense-defense balance in military strategy away from offense and high-risk approaches and high-risk investments toward more defensive capabilities, a more defensive force posture. And this helps you like buy down the risks of war, especially inadvertent war. That's very sensible, right? Spending less on defense, which is also very sensible because military superiority is not, you know, sustainable fiscally or politically. They could be a little, they could go a little further on North Korea, but they of course like endorse engagement and diplomacy and like an end to the Korean War. They are opposed to decoupling with China, and yet they are in favor of sort of like selective constraints or prohibitions on allowing Chinese access to certain technology areas. They approve decoupling in select areas in the name of national security, just not decoupling of the economies in total, right? So like they're still making the economic interdependence wager. I don't know how I feel about that, but like in a broad sense, these principles are like hard to disagree with. And it just struck me, one, that somehow this is all controversial, but two, like there are areas of agreement. Like I don't see why this should be controversial. As a starting point for policy, they sort of reinforce a status quo on Taiwan. They're not about to like abandon Taiwan, but they also are not trying to provoke a war in the name of defending Taiwan. Again, like that's kind of a reasonable position in the current climate, it feels like a very contrarian position. And so, like, this is, these principles are not getting a lot of love in Washington among my, like, establishment friends. But I don't know, like, this is like a very reasonable thing. And so it's just worth keeping an eye on. And then when you have stuff like selective decoupling that they favor, that's kind of where a lot of, like, sane people in Washington are anyways. It's like, oh, we do need to keep China out of certain sectors of high technology, right? We do need to be wary about the national security implications of Chinese collaboration or Chinese investment in certain areas, right? There's a pragmatism here that in the current climate seems extreme. So anyways, it's worth flagging.
Let's do Prediction Market, where we get Van to predict outcomes from today's current events and keep track of them.
All right, Prediction Market this week, we're going to start thanks to one of our comrades, Mitchell, who helps behind the scenes. He's done a whole spreadsheet for us to decide whether Van was right or wrong about the predictions, and we've got two right ones to start off with, Van. So question one that was asked a few weeks ago, will any resolutions be put out between India and China regarding this week's border disputes, this week being a few months ago, before the end of the month? And you got that right, Van. You predicted that the situation would stabilize itself, but would remain unresolved, and that's exactly what's happened. And the second question was, will we see any international pushback to the Russian COVID-19 vaccine being used in the Philippines? And you also got this one right. You said it probably wouldn't happen anyway, and if it did, you shouldn't trust it. And it appears it's been pushed back, and there hasn't actually been given sufficient reason why. So I can only imagine that it's because they realize that it probably won't work.
Yeah, because it's a Russian, claim to a vaccine. Are you going to let the Russians inject you with biological anything? Like,
yeah.
Fuck. Yeah. Anyways, that's good to know. Yes. So we are keeping track, listeners, of the Prediction Market questions. We just don't always talk about it.
And to start off this week, the last 2 weeks has been an absolute shit show, and we can only talk about so much. Question one, will Azerbaijan or Armenia withdraw troops from Nagorno-Karabakh before November?
Yes, so this is it's the freshest iteration of like a very long-standing conflict. It's not exactly like a new war. But I'm going to say no, they're not going to withdraw before November, in part because there's nothing. We were asked, you asked a question about this some months ago, like whether this flashpoint would heat up. And I...
whether it would help COVID, actually. I had a totally wrong idea, and I thought these guys could work together.
No, yeah. And Azerbaijan is being backed by Turkey, who is operating basically like a neo-imperial foreign policy, but nobody is calling it that because they still host U.S. nukes for some bizarre fucking reason, and they're still part of NATO for some fucking weird reason. So basically, like, you're having like a replay of 19th century kind of like imperial politics happening in this part of the world, and Azerbaijan and Armenia are like falling into that, but they have their own deep historical rivalry anyway. Mm-hmm. And of course, the Armenians and the Turks, right? Armenians were the first genocide in modern history because of the fucking Turks, right? There's a lot of complication here that makes this all a powder keg, but it also prevents incentives for restraint. In the current context, there's nothing to check a conflict on Armenia and Azerbaijan, right? Not high levels of economic interdependence. Azerbaijan is not a democracy. You have Azerbaijan basically being a proxy for Turkey. You have historical identity conflicts, territorial dispute. And then you've got like high levels of unemployment and a very dark, short shadow of the future because of COVID and everything else. Like, it's just like problem on top of problem. And so like I was expecting that there would be a flare-up in places like this all over the world, including between Armenia and Azerbaijan. And that's what's happened. So yeah, I don't see troop withdrawals happening before November.
I should probably have put this like as a covert AMA question, but where did Turkey get off, in your opinion, then, doing that, like essentially funding an oil state to just, and also second part is why the hesitancy of the foreign policy establishment to call this a war? Because I've seen over the past weeks, 2 weeks that this has been going on, everyone in the establishment really just can't get that idea that it's a war in their head. It's still a border clash. And it sort of feels like it's been whitewashed a little bit because the border clash really does not sound that serious in the context of what's going on today. But it's a full-on drone war. And over 3,000 Armenians have died.
Yeah. So, no, it's a war by like reasonable or objective measures. Yeah, it is being downplayed though, in part because if you spotlight it too much, it becomes like fucking Bosnia or something where it's like you have to do something. And basically right now, nobody is in a position to do anything about this. And everybody's attention is drawn away from this one specific thing. And you know who's paying attention? Turkey. I mean, I think Turkey is involved in a way that's going to perpetuate the conflict for the foreseeable future. And there's nothing that nobody has bandwidth for this. So I haven't noticed that people are not calling it a war, but it also doesn't surprise me.
Well, I have to thank you, Van. You've just vindicated 2 weeks of my Twitter rants. Question two. This is more in your area, I would think. Will India seek to openly increase its military presence in the Maldives before the end of the year? And this is inspired by a story from Asia Times describing how India is losing its military hold on the Maldives that it's had since 1988 when soldiers intervened in a coup.
Yeah, this is funny. Not funny, but like the Maldives is, since the 80s, has been part of an Indian sphere of influence. Right? Spheres of influence are generally bad. But it's kind of off the radar. We don't think of India having a sphere of influence, but it is the Indian subcontinent. Like, it's part of that whole Indian Ocean region, keyword being India, right? And so India, except for, you know, Pakistan, exercises tremendous sway over this sub-region. And it's in ways that are traditional sphere of influence oftentimes, like in the Maldives, but like it's not in our imagination that India maintains a sphere of influence that is controlling and exclusionary. Like, they have actual troops on the ground. It turns out that people perceive in the Maldives, at least, that India is heavy-handed and that the military is not something that they want in their country, but India is there anyway. And I don't see India increasing troop presence for the sake of the prediction. But it is a precarious hold, right? There's popular resentment against India's military presence there.
That's interesting. I didn't think, maybe that just speaks to my ignorance. I never would have thought the Maldives would have been a place for anti-militarist activity. But, you know, it just shows you what we don't know, really. Question three. And I know I've asked a question similar to this before, but this is in response to a story by AP News where the United Kingdom is actively preparing human rights sanctions against Belarusian administration officials. Will any other European powers levy sanctions against Belarus or individuals within their administration before January next year?
So I'm going to say yes, but don't ask me who. I'm not sure who will follow suit, but I have to believe that the UK is not going to be the cheese standing alone here. Like, there will be others, because in EU politics right now, there is a recognition of Belarus basically being authoritarianized, or like whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And so there is surely going to be sanctions from other countries. We'll just have to see who.
Do you see sanctions in this instance, especially for Belarus, a country that's already struggling economically? Do you see that as pushing the populace and the administration more into the arms, further into the arms of Russia? Or do you feel like it's going to have, whatever they're trying to do is going to work?
Well, so the UK sanctions are supposed to be targeted. So
yeah,
they're naming individuals. The US pioneered this approach of like, you sanction individuals like elites who are decision makers, so that then they can't operate in the international banking system. They can't transact in foreign currency, right? You name specific firms that matter to the government so that they can't.
Like the criminal court, right?
Yeah.
And the so, ICC. Like,
yeah. And so you, the UK's sanctions are supposed to be targeted in that way. And if that's the case, then you're unlikely to see, you know, popular alignment with, you know, let's say Russia, but you might see elites in Belarus, which is not accountable to the public, right? They might more openly align with Russia, even though they already are. So I'm not sure what that would even mean.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's prediction market this week.
Boom.
Time for Save Twitter, where we curate the best and worst of Twitter so that you don't have to.
Okay, so for Stay Off Twitter, first one is from my man Dan Nexon, professor at Georgetown, godfather of progressive foreign policy, author of many things, guest on the show. He is tweeting on top of Chuck Grassley, who's a Republican senator in the U.S., and so obviously Chuck Grassley has been part of most things that are bad in America for the past 30 years. And so Chuck Grassley says, I turned to the History Channel to see if there was any history. There was not any history. Instead, The Pickers was on.
Ancient Aliens.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Big mistake on my part. So that's what Chuck Grassley said. And then Dan Nexon, remembering the history of the History Channel, he says, hey, everyone, remember when the GOP majority in the 90s told us we could get rid of PBS because the History Channel and A&E and TLC would fill the gap? And then on the other hand, Big Bird is on HBO now, so who knows? And so he's pointing out, like, PBS, Public Broadcasting Station, it's like free, it's accessible everywhere in the United States. Even if when you don't have cable, you have access to PBS. And it's what Sesame Street used to be on. And it is public interest, kind of information, educational television. And it's publicly funded. The Republicans, starting in the 80s, even before the 90s, were trying to defund public broadcasting. And the argument that they made was what Nexon was pointing out, which is like, look, we have the History Channel, which is a privately owned for-profit station, right? They will give us the history that we need. They will give us our educational content on TV. The irony of Chuck Grassley is that, like, he was an advocate of allowing the History Channel to be the source of visual education on history in favor of defunding PBS, right? Where you would have actual, you know, documentaries on history or whatever.
Oh.
And Chuck Grassley is just blissfully unaware of his own role in creating this monster. Like, of course, the corporatization and the for-profit motive of, like, individual TV channels is going to go where the money is, which is in sensationalism and the fucking Pickers, as opposed to documentaries about white supremacy in America or whatever, you know, like how we fucking genocided the Indians. So, like, you're not going to see that stuff on the History Channel. You're going to see Ancient Aliens. And so shout out to Nexon for calling out the irony / hypocrisy.
It was really funny because when I saw the tweet for the first thing, I didn't realize that was the connection in the first place. And I'm speaking this as, like, the oldest one out of, like, the kiddies on the podcast, right? But I was kind of like, because the tweet itself was already like, hey, remember the 90s? And I was like, no. Yeah, but then you mentioned the trigger. Yeah. I was like, no, what's the connection here? What are these words?
Yes.
Yeah.
This is the thing. Like, there's so many choices that were made in the recent past that constrain our future, and, like, we make our future, and it's shitty right now because we made shitty decisions, shitty neoliberal decisions. Fuck. All right. Second tweet. Dude is a correspondent at Vox, Zach Bochamp. I don't know how you pronounce his name, but he's he's talking about the vice presidential debate, which happened in the recent past, and he just goes, I cannot stress enough how stupid it is that this is happening, A, in person at all, B, with candidates unmasked, and C, with a live audience. And yeah, very much so, right? A, B, and C here. I have a problem. I think I said this before, or maybe it was during our like hiatus last week, but I have a problem with doing these debates at all as if the other guy's not trying to sabotage democracy. Like you have the leading, you have the incumbent. Yeah. One of the parties here is actively trying to prevent an election from happening fairly. And you're going to engage in debate and other rituals as if it's all just fucking normal? You're like legitimizing him in some way. You're buying into a process that he is rigging so that you lose. It's like, I don't get it. Like, what are you gaining from doing the debate other than like, I don't know, whitewashing all this bad shit that he's doing? So I have a problem with that. But also like the fact that like you're putting these candidates in a room together and one of them was exposed to the president who had COVID, and that the White House has become a petri dish for the fucking coronavirus because of their stupidity. And Mike Pence has been exposed to that, you know?
Yeah. Remember Trump has COVID? We forgot to mention
that. Yeah. Other things that have happened the past 2 weeks. Yeah, fuck. I don't believe or disbelieve it. I don't even have an opinion whether he actually got it because like, I don't believe anything that he says, but I also am not interested in like promoting conspiracy theory about him and like just because like Michael Moore said something, so I'm going to repeat it. Like, I'm not going to do that.
You exactly. Know?
You also can't trust him, and it serves his interests to like present himself as like beating COVID. And that could be legitimate or not, but it kind of doesn't matter.
I'm of the opinion if Michael Moore says it's true, it's probably not anyway. So I think that that's a safe assumption.
Yeah, like I'm not willing to say that he's faking it. I'm not willing to say that. But I'm also not willing to assume he has it. Don't take a side, like, I don't care, man. It's like asking me about fucking Kim Kardashian. Like, I don't know. Like, I don't care.
POTUS having COVID, Kim Kardashian. Yeah, that's about it. That's
next on True Analysis is 100% going to be all about Kim Kardashian.
Oh, yeah.
I can give you an ironclad guarantee.
Right on. So, moving on to my tweets for the week. My first one is coming from Josh Lederman over at NBC News. So, his tweet reads, serious question for legal experts out there. Is there potential criminal or civil exposure if you know you're contagious with something, decline to take steps to avoid transmitting it, and someone else gets sick? Like, I know the last 2 weeks have been crazy with the news, like, for sure, but I think, like, the only answer, like, I could properly find, like, for this question is from the Justice Department and Deputy Attorney General, who said that because coronavirus appears to meet the statutory definition of biological agent, such acts potentially could implicate the nation's terrorism-related statutes, right? Which is crazy. Could Trump actually legitimately be considered like a terrorist at this point?
He is a fucking terrorist. That's the thing. That's the weird. That's so, like the Josh's tweet is like not a hot take, but it raises this question that I had the other day that I didn't put it to anybody. It was just like I kept it in my head for once. But if Trump were to just like walk around the White House with a fucking like AR-15, just shooting every few people. And like, would anybody stop him? Would the Secret Service even stop him? Would he be brought up on charges? I don't think so. As long as he can, as long as he can like issue an executive order and say some things that's like, well, it was a national emergency. I had to do it. Like if he just has to say words that rationalize what he's doing. And even if it doesn't make sense, he gets away with it. And like, that's where we are. And that's walking around shooting people in the White House is not different than walking around and knowingly giving them coronavirus. Like the only difference is that they may or may not die when they get coronavirus, but you don't know and they don't know, right? Like it's like you're making them all play Russian roulette. This is the fucking, the Russian czar right before Catherine the Great that was like a fucking sociopath. It's like you're walking around making people play these games of death on your behalf, you know, just for your whims. Yeah. I don't know. It's a very interesting question. And yeah, Trump is a fucking terrorist. It's just a question of whether he gets held accountable for it or not.
The state of things when the president of the United States being a terrorist is not a hot take.
Yeah.
The state of things.
It's so fucked up.
I'm not trying to be cute. He's fucking making decisions that kill people.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? Yeah. For political purposes, not the national interest.
Yeah, it was like kind of depressing to read it, and then it was like probably nothing gonna get held accountable on his end, and yeah, and then you just basically confirmed him, like, oh, that shit's not depressing. Anyway, awesome. So on to my second tweet of the week from Robert Kelly over at Busan National University. We've mentioned him a couple of times in the pod.
ABC Dad.
So I forget, does he like or hate that? Or mentioned
he used to hate it. Now he just kind of owns it. I think he capitalized, yeah. Like he makes a lot of money off of it. So now he really Legit. Owns it.
Rate it. Anyway, yep. So his tweet refers to an overview from Foreign Policy about buying F-35s, which is in this like neat chart that visually shows all these countries and how much they're buying. So included in the chart was South Korea. To this, Kelly goes, someone tell me why South Korea needs F-35s, much less 40 of them, when North Korean Air Force sounds like a punchline to a joke. And I figured, flag it down, you're probably one of the best to talk about this band, so go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, so the North Korean Air Force, it is a joke. It is literally early Soviet era technology for the most part. I think like the MiG-29 might be the most advanced fighter in their arsenal. South Korea has air superiority over North Korea. There's just no fucking question. And so in that context, it does look on the face of things like the F-35 is quite a boondoggle, or it's curious. And the reason is because, one, South Korea already has air superiority, but two, the F-35, if you don't know, is super fucking expensive. And it's the ultimate symbol of like the military acquisitions albatross, like how broken the system is. The F-35 was designed based on requirements for defeating the Soviet Union in the 80s. So it's this multi-role fighter aircraft. It took 30 years to get this thing actually into production in the field, like to have it be like a real thing that's part of the force. 30 fucking years. The world changed. Like, of course, the world changes dramatically over the span of 30 years. So like the enemy that you were designing this thing to combat stopped existing a long time ago. And yet you're still building it out and advancing it and promoting it. And now it's one of the most advanced fighters in the world. And so the U.S. defense industry, who invested all kinds of time and effort to build this fucking monstrosity, it's a high functioning monstrosity. It's just very expensive, like billions and billions of dollars. But like they've got this capacity, and the U.S. has no need for more F-35s now. And the U.S. can't afford to keep acquiring them anyway. And they're not the most advanced fighter in the world anymore within the U.S. arsenal, right? And so with this excess slack, what do you do with the slack? You fucking find people to buy it. So now it's like this major export for any country who's not wantonly violating human rights, who wants to pay us a bunch of money to get an advanced Air Force. They can acquire it, you know? And we've got the trainers for it. We can get them set up, logistics and maintenance and everything. The proliferation of F-35s, it's because if you're buying them, you're trying to buy yourself a modern Air Force capability. And the question in the South Korea context, given the price tag, is like, why? And the answer is actually, there is like a real answer to it. It's not all just corruption, although there is some corruption here. It's that South Korea uses the F-35 among other capabilities in what it calls the kill chain, which is the process of launching like rapid precision strikes against North Korean targets in the event that North Korea's got like a missile on the launch pad and is about to attack or something like that. The kill chain concept, it's basically precision targeting. And so you need the ability to like respond rapidly and precisely. It doesn't have to take the form of the F-35. It could take many forms, but they've built the concept around the F-35 in part. And so that's how they like justify it. And the shell game that militaries and governments play in this space is often that you justify a decision to acquire a certain capability because it's like, look, here's the use case. In this kind of scenario, which is plausible, this capability would help us by doing this and that, right? We like in this case, it's like, well, if North Korea's got a missile on the launch pad and we need to strike it quickly, we can scramble an F-35 and boom, right?
For sure. Yeah.
But it's like, is that the most efficient investment? What are the opportunity costs? What's the likelihood versus plausibility of that? Do you actually need to invest, you know, $5 billion per fighter, per fucking unit, in order to have that capability? Does that actually make sense?
Even if it's in the ballpark, that's fucking huge.
Yeah. And so it's like, that's why it's a shell game. They're talking about, well, this is plausible, here's how it's useful, but without comparing it, without actually putting it to scrutiny about, like, is this best use? Is this best value for money? Does this make the most strategic sense? All they do is clear that minimum threshold. Is it sensible enough? Is it more than not useful? That's the threshold they use. Oh, it could plausibly be used to fucking pick steak out of our teeth. Then that's good enough. Anyways, shout out to Bob.
Let's jump into Armchair Analysis, where we dive into a different piece every week and tell you all about it.
This week, we're going to focus on a piece called No, Biden Will Not End Trade Wars by Edward Alden, a trade policy wonk, writing for Foreign Policy. And the piece is quite a critical take on Biden's trade policy. He writes, if Democratic candidate Joe Biden becomes president next January, mending US trade relations won't be anywhere near the top of his to-do list. He has stated unequivocally that he would not enter into any new trade agreements until we've made major investments here at home, in our workers, in our communities. The obvious reason, of course, that Biden is taking this kind of critical perspective on trade, or at least deprioritizing it, is because Democrats are terrified that discontent over trade helped Trump win the 2016 election, particularly in Midwest states and the blue wall that crumbled in 2016. But Alden points out that after 4 years of Trump, he writes, the international trade system is collapsing. A short list of the urgent priorities include fixing a broken World Trade Organization, building a stronger alliance to confront China economically, and resolving growing differences with Europe over taxation of and privacy regulations for digital companies, as well as avoiding a spiral of new trade conflicts over the use of border taxes to punish carbon-hungry industries. And Alden goes further to say that Biden's plans might make trade conflicts worse. So he points to a $400 billion Buy American scheme that he says would cut off many highly competitive European and Asian suppliers, and also Biden's kind of willingness to provide government subsidies to certain industries. So what Alden suggests is kind of a short list of goodwill gestures from a potential Biden administration, including restoring and preserving the World Trade Organization, renouncing tariff wars with allies. And finally, he writes, Biden will need to deliver on his promise to work closely with allies early and consistently on a common trade policy toward China. He concludes that an about-face on trade would deepen rifts with the increasingly powerful left wing of the Democratic Party and make Biden and the party vulnerable to Trump's Republican successors. I think it was particularly interesting that he mentioned the risk of global spats over border taxes punish carbon-hungry industries, because I think that's probably the most likely source of trade conflict going forward. But I felt uncomfortable about his prescriptions, because I also agree with the kind of Biden prioritization of focusing on domestic build back first. And it seems like a really crucial area where progressive foreign policy falls down a lot is this idea of how do you do trade? How do you engage with the world around you in the way that you need to without hollowing out your own country at the same time? And I was interested to hear what you thought, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, one of the progressive takes on how you answer that question is through transnational labor solidarity. And so that if you have that, it prevents the governments that you're trying to do business with in the developing world or whatever from underpricing your labor by exploiting its own labor, right? So it's like solidarity becomes the mechanism that protects both sides so that corporations don't collaborate with governments against civil society, right? And so it's like a reimagining of like how you do these power politics. On this piece itself, this piece is a very good example of why Biden is likely to get pulled in competing directions that undermine the guy's argument. Like, the guy's argument is kind of like coming from that neoliberal free trade is good place. And that's not where, I don't know, like, I'm not sure that that's where the majority of people are. Like, certainly not the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, right? Progressives, the one thing I would say is, like, progressives have not reckoned with the role of economic interdependence in producing stability and producing peace. But they, by and large, do not accept that. Like, to them, the capital peace is not a thing. You know, this piece here in foreign policy, it's making an argument for why Biden should focus on the frame of trade conflict is a bit much. We're talking about tariffs and protectionist measures, right? We're talking about trade agreements, but then framing like, well, the absence of trade agreements means trade conflict because it sounds nastier. Right? That's a pretty like liberal, neoliberal frame. And that's not the frame that the progressive wing has. It's not the frame that the Trumpists even have anymore. And so like the piece is arguing from that constituency. You're going to see chambers of commerce make arguments like what this guy is making in order to put pressure on Biden to mend trade ties and to reduce tariff barriers, to seek new trade agreements, to seek things like re-entry into the TPP, right? And so like when I wrote in Foreign Policy a few weeks ago or a month ago or whatever it was, I was like, liberal internationalism itself is of two minds, right? Political liberalism versus economic liberalism have always kind of been in tension. Biden has signed up to that agenda and it pulls him in competing directions on China. It pulls him in competing directions in general, right? On economic policy. So you have a climate in Washington that is increasingly open to protectionism, especially on national security grounds, especially on the 800-pound gorilla, China. But then you have Silicon Valley, who has not changed their mindset about China. You have a free trade lobby. Any industry that actually exports goods or services abroad is going to want a more stable trading environment, and they're going to put lobbying pressure on the Biden administration. So, like, once again, political versus economic liberalism, not political plus economic liberalism. Like, there's a tension between these things, and because of who Biden is, like, I have every expectation that this doesn't resolve in favor of either. It's going to be satisficing, muddled compromise, or like internal incoherence, a lack of logical consistency. And it's going to be partly because lots of people with moneyed interests are going to write pieces like this foreign policy piece to pull Biden in the direction of like keeping open the free trading system, preserving the World Trade Organization, even though like lots of people on the left have don't think it should exist either, right? This piece, like, I'm not sure that I agree with the prescriptions, like you said. I also am not fully on board with the critique because it serves a particular purpose. And the irony is that, like, the purpose that it serves, which is to try and nudge Biden toward prioritizing a free trade agenda, that is not something that I necessarily share, and it's not something that is seen as a public good as it used to be. Reading the piece in that context, I think, is very good. Like, this is a useful thing to, like, have in the conversation. It's not the kind of piece that, like, I'm co-signing, I guess.
That's really useful, I think. And I think that's actually a really good demonstration of why this is going to sound incredibly cheesy, but it is important to have that kind of marketplace of ideas, right? Because you get those productive tensions as a result. So
marketplace of ideas. Really, how dare you? How dare you, Klaus Schwab? This Davos man.
That was half serious and then half just designed to entirely trigger that.
Well played. Well played.
Okay, sweet. Well, that's Armchair for this week.
Nice.
All right, time for Ask Me Anything, where people ask me anything.
All right, so Ask Me Anything this week. Got a couple questions here. First one is from Ayn Randy. So, Van, how do you feel about Coney Barrett's nomination to the SCOTUS? Will any positives possibly come from this?
Yeah, so obviously Amy Coney Barrett is Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court. If she gets confirmed, which I don't know, seems plausible, then the court will be like a 6-3 conservative majority court, which means that like some version of Trumpism will be the like law of the land for a fucking generation. And it doesn't even matter who wins the presidency year, term after term. Like the it's like rigging the game at a higher level. The only positive that will come out of this, obviously, like, I don't feel fucking good to answer the question. I don't feel good about it at all. But if there's good to come out of it, it's that like there's a huge mandate now among progressives. And it seemed like Biden was hinting at this, too, that he might pack the court, like he might add, like currently there are 9 Supreme Court justices. And we haven't like seriously tried to do this since the days of like Franklin Roosevelt. But he might add Supreme Court justices, and that that would dilute the Republican control over the Supreme Court. It's hugely controversial in the sense that it's always been considered a nuclear option, but it's like, we're way past that now. We're in actual Civil War Part II territory. If you fucking
damage control.
Yeah, like adding people to the Supreme Court is like the least you can do. And the hypocrisy of Mitch McConnell in the Senate, the Republican, he's the one who prevented Obama from appointing a Supreme Court justice in the final year of his term in office in 2016, because his excuse was like, let the people decide. And we're about to have an election. So like, let's wait until after the election. So he blocked Obama appointing a very reasonable Supreme Court justice. And he has flipped that argument now that it's in Trump's final year in office, an election year. And he's saying, look, we need to appoint this person while we can, because they may not have a chance to appoint them later. So, this is all very gross, and it increases the strength of the argument to pack the court, in my opinion. I think if Coney Barrett is confirmed, then all bets are off. There's no reason not to go nuclear.
Wow.
Am I right to assume is that she did speeches for what I would call a hate group that uses gay conversion therapy still? She went and did a speech for them, like for the importance of the family.
Oh yeah.
And it's like the Supreme Court, like these people run the land essentially. If you want to get to the end point of how laws are passed, these guys are it. And you can't have that in 2020. It just doesn't work. You can't have that in a progressive society. You can't have someone that thinks that batshit sort of crap works.
Yeah. She's like from that big Catholics are, I did my PhD at Catholic University, so it's not like I don't know fucking Catholics, but there's like a subset of Catholics who are that fucking crazy Handmaid's Tale kind of Catholic. And like, that's what she is. The kind that fucking in a Dan Brown novel is like whipping themselves in the basement and doing like weird shit. That's her space. So nobody should feel good about that.
Well, that gives us a lot of hope for the SCOTUS thing then.
Trump nominated her so that she could be confirmed in the next month, but or 2 months or whatever. But well, you know, who knows? We'll see.
We'll see. Anyway, so second question from Hot Trotsky. Why is Russia's sphere of influence imploding at such a quick rate? Will Putin use this as a launching pad for re-Sovietization?
What is the context of this? Do you know, Jake? I'm not.
It was from a friend of mine. I promise Hot Trotsky is not me. I said that as soon as you put that as your name, they're going to blame me for this. But it's on the back of a story from Foreign Affairs, I think it was, about Russia's neighborhood. There's an uprising in Kyrgyzstan, the Armenia and Azerbaijan issue. Uzbekistan is going through a lot of trouble at the moment. And it just seems Russia's sphere is... And Belarus, obviously.
Yeah.
And Ukraine is still engaged in an active war in Ukraine. It just seems like it's actively imploding in a way that it did when Putin assumed power. And his first reaction to when he assumed power was to go for a war in Georgia and Chechnya.
Yeah, so it seems like Russia under Putin has kind of doubled down on trying to preserve and expand a Russian sphere of influence. In Russian strategic culture, even you know from the Cold War days when it was the Soviet Union, the idea of geographic buffers and maintaining spheres of influence in order to have geographic buffers, that was like a real way of thinking. And like that's how, you know, like, you know, strategists in the Kremlin would think about foreign policy. And Putin, who is a creature of that era, creature of that culture, he has clearly pursued that. And I mean, with what he's done in the US, it's like way past just having a sphere of influence or a buffer. Like he's pretty, he's aggressive. To the extent that, you know, Russia is receiving like negative feedback or pushback in its own periphery, its resistance to Russia, like asserting its sphere of influence, to me, it's almost like if Putin didn't try so hard, he might be able to have more influence. Like that's the irony here.
And so my last question here is from Anonymous. What is the Indo-Pacific Quad? Is it encircling China? Is it defending Asia?
So this kind of question has come up a lot recently, or this issue has come up a lot. So the Quad is a meeting, it's a fucking meeting, okay, between India, Australia, the US, and Japan. It's framed as like, these are Asia's maritime democracies. I don't know anybody who thinks of India as a maritime power, for one, but like, that's like the notion. And it's true that they're all democracies. India's on the bubble, America's on the bubble, but they're all democracies for now. And this meeting was happening before Trump came to office. It was just an occasional meeting. It's like a check-in of like-minded countries, like a subgroup within Asia. You know, you think I want democracies to work together. Democracies have a common agenda. Guess what? Autocrats will not protect democracy. Only democracies can. Only democracies will. What does that mean? How do you protect democracy? That's where shit gets contentious, right? Or controversial. But the notion that like the country's big democracies would get together for a meeting doesn't exactly discomfort me. Like I would endorse that, all things being equal. That's a good thing. The controversy is that since Trump came to office, the Quad has been used as this signal or valence to indicate that you're against China. It's considered like the China encirclement coalition. And the Trump administration has openly kind of like advertised it that way. But the Quad, like in US government official kind of talking points, the Quad is not that big of a deal. It's a recurring meeting that you have of like foreign ministers. Like Pompeo just had a meeting recently with the Quad. You talk about it as like a line in a speech kind of thing, but it's not a big deal in the US government. Where it's a big deal is in the pundit space. Like people who are the policy intelligentsia or whatever in Washington, in Canberra, in the region, in Singapore, they all talk about the Quad. And it's like this lightning rod for controversy. And it reminds, like I said on Twitter, like it's a speech act institution. It's like you say it exists, therefore it exists. But when you like actually scrutinize what it does, it doesn't do shit. It is literally a recurring meeting. And that's what's weird about it, is that it's like this, people have very strong opinions about it, but it's just a meeting. If this is the mechanism for containing China, and that's the goal, it's wildly incommensurate means to put against the end of something as ambitious as containing China. This is a horrible vehicle to try and like achieve some strategic outcome in the region. It's just because why? It's a fucking meeting. But having said that, why would you not want the region's democracies to get together? Why would you not like, what would be the problem with that? You know, like people have very strong opinions about this. And at best, it's like coordinating stuff that was already happening. And that doesn't seem like such a bad thing. I compared it to Belt and Road Initiative in the sense that Belt and Road is this concept that scholars and pundits, media people talk about, but it's basically just a slogan that you put on top of a bunch of bilateral deals that China does with smaller countries. And it's like, okay, the great power is doing what a great power always does, trying to strike favorable bilateral deals. And that often involves investment and aid, right? But then you put this like slogan on it, Belt and Road Initiative, and suddenly it's a lightning rod for controversy on both sides. Okay, all of China was doing this stuff before it had the Belt and Road concept. But now that you're treating it as a concept and debating it and making it a point of controversy, it is it's way more of a threat than it used to be if you're against it. And if you're for it, like you're in China, it becomes a justification for you to do more of these bilateral deals in the name of advancing the Belt and Road Initiative or whatever. And it's like, this stuff is going to happen regardless of whether you call it that. But like, pundits turn these things into symbols or signals and objects to fight over, and like, it elevates their importance. And it's like, when you think about what actually is happening and what you're actually talking about, it's more modest. That's how I see the Quad. It's this modest thing that is being inflated in good ways and bad. All right, gang, that's going to do it. Just a reminder, if you have questions to shoot us for the Ask Me Anything segment, it's askmeanything@undiplomaticpodcast.com. Shoot your questions. Maybe it ends up on the show. And buymeacoffee.com/undiplomatic to send us money. All right. Catch you next time.
Peace.